You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores. Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Silent Village is a new book by Robert Pike. It's a powerful story about life and death in occupied France. What happened on the 10th of June 1944 in a picturesque village in the rural heart of France when an armoured panzer division rolled in. It is the story told by Robert Pike. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Robert himself. Robert, good morning to you.
Morning. Hi.
Good to have
you. Hi, Giles.
Good to have you with us. Set the scene, if you will. It is 1944. Allies have landed in France. What happens next?
Yeah, so this all happened very, very soon after the Allies landed in Normandy. We had, that was the 6th of June, 1944. And what was happening was the Nazi high command was starting to think about moving troops north towards Normandy. There was a panzer division they was kind of doing a bit of a recovery down in the south of France following their operations in the east of Europe. And before going north, they were instructed to kind of try and eliminate as much of the resistance as they could in the south of France, the south and the central part of France. There was a fair bit of resistance activity going on there. And really... there was just an order that they were to particularly make one brutal lasting strike, and it was unfortunately a village called Ordos-sur-Glane, which had no resistance in it, which unfortunately kind of was in the wrong place at the wrong time, really. The Das Reich was responsible for a lot of atrocities, not just in France but in Eastern Europe. But this one in Ordo in particular was the particularly brutal one.
I mean, whereabouts in France is this? Because I mean, it's not in Normandy, is it? It's actually in, if you like, central France, is it?
Yeah. So it's Ordo is it's about I don't know, about 10 miles to the west of Limoges. So I guess about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of sort of Toulouse, central France, sort of west central, in Haute-Vienne is the département that it's in. Yeah.
And so, what actually occurred then on this day? Because this is an SS Panzer division as well, isn't it? I mean, it's important to know that the if you like, the military hierarchy and the Nazi hierarchy in the Wehrmacht at the time.
Yeah, I mean, One thing I will say is my book isn't about that Panzer Division. Okay, that's been covered in other books.
Right.
Max Hastings did a great book about the Das Reich, which does cover the Ojador massacre as part of it. But yes, it was. I mean, what was happening at that point was that there was quite a few Wehrmacht division, kind of local kind of battalions, I suppose, being left in various towns and villages in that part of France. And what was happening was, as the 6th of June happened, some of the resistance groups in that area, particularly the communist groups, because they'd always worked on a kind of let's act as and when we can, whereas de Gaulle wanted to hold the resistance back until everything was ready. But some of these communists, these FTP resistance groups, started kind of liberating small towns, and unfortunately, because they were these Wehrmacht battalions left in these small towns, places like Guéret and Toul, what happened there was the Wehrmacht, which tended to be sort of older. Not the kind of elite troops. They were overcome, and so what happened then? As the Das Reich was brought in through that region, was they were sent to some of these places like Toul, and they reclaimed those places. Guéret was another one. In Guéret, there were 22 Maquis resistance fighters killed. In Toul, there were 99. Maquis fighters hanged from, well, I say Maquis fighters, they could have been, they were primarily people who lived in the town, men who lived in the town. They were hanged from the from lampposts. Mm. And that was the day before the massacre in Ojador. So all this was going on. And so the SS Das Reich was almost going in and overcoming then, the resistance. Strangely enough, though, that wasn't really happening anywhere near Ojador, particularly. There was another Ojador. There's a number of Ojador. It's quite a common name in that part of France. But there's another one which is called Ojador sur Vair, which is about 30 kilometers to the southwest of Ojador sur Glane. There was Maquis activity in that village, but there's no way that the Das Reich confused them. They were too good for that.
The subtitle of the book is Life and Death in Occupied France. What was, because you look at the reason, I mean, you look at the what life was like for villages in Vichy France and occupied France. What was the day-to-day existence like for these villages? Because they're far away from the fighting. I mean, is it a question of life going on pretty much as it had before?
Well, this is the big focus of my book, really. Although this, in the second part of the book, I do tell the story of the massacre and what happened in the days and weeks afterwards. The first part really is about ordinary people, but it tells the story of how life had changed, because a few important things had happened. The French war as such against Germany only lasted for a number of months, from October into sort of June, and then France was overcome in June 1940, and you had this huge exodus of people coming south. And a lot of people from Alsace-Lorraine, for example, couldn't go back because they were French speakers, so they weren't allowed to go back to Alsace-Lorraine, which had been Germanized. You also had people from Spain that come over during the Spanish Civil War. They'd escaped. There was a camp actually in Ojador between 1941 and 1942, it's called a GTE. It was kind of a work detail camp. So there were Spanish people living in Ojador. You had people from Alsace-Lorraine. It was so you had new people there. You also had people being sent there, children who'd been sent there because it was a place of safety. It was quiet. It was in the countryside. And in terms of daily life, well, daily life had changed because when France lost the war in June 1940, Pétain, who would become the kind of the, I suppose the the leader of France. He had full powers. He declared that France was in a kind of mourning. So, the dances and the balls that the young people would generally have gone to was that kind of thing was all stopped. You couldn't have these musical events. And then you had restrictions kicking in. So as the time went on, people couldn't get what they needed in towns. So things like milk and eggs and those sorts of things, vegetables. A strange thing happened in the countryside, which is that as things couldn't get to those shops, people started to come out to the countryside. So people would come to places like Ordor, and particularly the farms and the villages around Ordor, to try and get what they needed, because they couldn't get these things from the normal places that they normally would in cities. Now, Ordor had a direct tram link from Limoges, which is a big city. So people used to come there, particularly on the weekend, to try and get foodstuffs. So actually the people in the villages became a little bit more comfortable during this period than they had been before, because suddenly they didn't have to go into the cities to try and sell their stuff, which cost them money.
I mean, I suppose the thing is, you tend to forget, you think of when you think of France, you think of, especially during the war, the big cities, you know, obviously Paris, you know, you mentioned the regions of Alsace-Lorraine, etc. But France is and has always been a predominantly the rural situation, especially in the 30s and the 40s.
Yeah, I mean, the 30s had been quite tough actually for the agricultural population, and this was a really agricultural population. You know, as soon as you got outside of a city in this part of France, you were in open countryside, and it was very, very agricultural. And during the 30s, they'd had a bit of a tough time, so it was an upturn for the farmers. A lot of the farmers in this part of France as well, a lot of them didn't own their own farms. They were what they called métayers. They were tenant farmers, and although some farmers, and there were obviously bigger farms that sold their wares, a lot of farms as well were kind of, they almost just existed on what they produced, particularly these smaller family-run tenant farms. So what they produced, they only sold kind of stuff to so that they could buy clothes and that kind of stuff. That was the money that they made there. So, but largely they were kind of self-sufficient. Whereas people in, I think one thing to realize about Ordor-sur-Glane is that although it was a village, it was what French sort of refer to as a bourg. It was the central part of a slightly larger area, which took in some hamlets and farms and things. So that was a kind of a central point. It had the things like the doctors and the shops where you might go and buy your textiles and things.
Sort of like a market town almost then, basically.
Exactly. It was, and the thing is, after the war, after the massacre particularly, this is how Charles de Gaulle wanted to portray Ordor, was as a place which is almost an idyllic place. And people did come there, particularly before the war. People came to Ordor-sur-Glane because it had some really nice restaurants. One of them was known as being a particularly, fine place to go and have food. There was the river running through. People came there to fish, to swim in the Glane. It was a really nice place. And de Gaulle wanted to retain that image of this idyllic, very innocent place which had been wiped off the face of the earth, which is, I think why he was particularly keen to preserve the village as it was on the day after it was destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned that it's 4 days after D-Day. I mean, was there the sense running through France that this was, well, presumably not, that the Germans were under pressure? I mean, I know things had been going bad for them in the Eastern Front, but this wasn't an age of social media, and the only information would have been highly censored and coming through what you would have got from the resistance, surely.
Yeah, I think so. But I also think people had the news about D-Day, and I think people were feeling a little bit more happy. I interviewed a number of people when writing this, and two of the people that I interviewed actually worked in Limoges. Actually, three of them worked in Limoges during the week and then came back to Ordu at the weekend. And so I think the thing about Ordu was although it was in the countryside, it had this direct link to a city. And I think in the city, people were quite aware of what was going on. Right. But then you had a village and you had the agricultural communities where, you know, people weren't that interested in reading newspapers and things like that. You know, I have to say, this part of France at this time, people were looking to survive. They were just looking to get by. They'd had 4 years. They'd hardly seen a German soldier in the countryside. You know, in Ordu, the only time that they saw a German soldier before the 10th of June was one day in November 1942, when France was fully occupied. Prior to that, and I think some German soldiers sort of drove through the village, but apart from that, they just didn't see any Germans. So it was a significant time. People were pleased, but I don't think people were celebrating as they would have been in other parts, particularly in the cities.
Mm. So, I mean, you say you spoke to people. You spoke to the few, well, the people who were contemporary, shall we say. I was going to say surviving, yeah. But that doesn't happen in this case. So, I mean, what do they remember? And B, you know, how big a mark has this left on the psyche of the French? Because, as you say, de Gaulle has made this village, you know, a monument to the barbarities of the occupying forces.
Yeah, I mean, it was 642 people were recorded as having died. Last year, we discovered that the number went up to 643 because there'd been an issue with the list, and actually it was a Spanish grandmother actually that had been left off the official list, and that was, she was added to the list last year. But yeah, the people I spoke to, actually they were survivors. They one of the gentlemen called Robert Ebra, he'd actually been in one of the barns. He was shot. He's got the bullet marks to prove it. So in one of the barns, because I'll quickly go backwards, what happened was that the men the men were put in barns, the women and children were put in the church. The men were all shot in the barns. In the church, the women and children were first asphyxiated, then they were shot at, and then the church was set on fire, as was the barns. So you can imagine it, you know, there were very few survivors. But out of one barn, six men managed to get out of one of the barns because the soldiers left the site just for a few minutes before they set fire to everything. Robert Ebra was one of those people, and he's told his story so many times, and it was interesting speaking to him because I sat down and he said, well, if you're going to tell me there was resistance in Ordu, you're going to prove it. And I was, you know, I said to him, look, I want to talk about Ordu before the massacre. I know your story. You've told it so many times. So that was interesting. And then there were a couple of other people who I spoke to. Camille Senon, she had been on a tram, and the tram arrived in the middle of the massacre. She arrived to see her parents. The people in the tram were led to a ditch that had been dug, and they stood next to this ditch, which was for them, for several hours before they were inexplicably set free. There was another interviewee who was a farmer's son who was looking after his cows, and a page from one of the books in the church landed at his feet, singed. But his sister went to collect two of her four children from Ordu halfway through, and she never came back, and she lost her children. And then the last one was André Desorteaux, who's his grandfather one of his grandfathers, was the mayor at the time of the massacre, Paul de Zotto. And his other grandfather was his main political opponent, who'd also been mayor of the village. So that was his other grandfather. And his story was one of his, almost like Romeo and Juliet. His father was the son of Joseph Beau, who's a socialist mayor who had been removed by Vichy. And his other grandfather was Paul de Zotto, who was the father of his mother. And the two men were aware that these two were having an affair, and then André was born, and this family was exiled to Limoges. It was an interesting story, and this kind of stuff that I'm really the book really tells. You know, all these personal stories of what was happening in this place, because you had a snapshot of a village at a certain moment in time, and I really wanted to portray that, because you had these refugees, you had Spanish people, you had people who'd been sent there for safety, you had children who'd been sent there for the summer, you had all these various types of people under surveillance, you had Jewish people hiding out, you had people hiding from forced work deportation to Germany. It was an interesting snapshot, really.
I mean, this is the thing. You did this with one of your previous books, Defying Vichy. I mean, do you think by taking that micro approach rather than the grand sweep when it comes to what was happening in the Second World War, that you can provide a much more personal and a much more poignant look at the ebbs and flows of history?
I think you have to, particularly with this period in this part of the world. But these specifics are really important. When we're looking at Vichy France, for example, we're looking at the resistance and collaboration. Over the decades, people have made these sweeping generalizations. And it just wasn't like that. You do have to look. Every place was a bit different. Every part of France was a bit different. If you look at the Haute-Vienne, for example, Oradour didn't have any resistance, and it suffered this brutal action just because it was in the way, and it was easy to surround. And unfortunately, French people on the ground knew that. It would be there wouldn't be any resistance to the Panzer Division going in there. You go to the other side of Limoges, though, and you had quite a major resistance operation there. So there were real specifics almost everywhere you went. And I like the idea of taking a small area and pulling it apart and looking at these personal stories. And this is the last chance we've got as well. Of the four survivors that I interviewed, one of them has already died, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And Defying Vichy, a lot of that was about a gentleman called Ralph Finkler, who joined the resistance. And unfortunately, he's recently died as well. And I'm really keen to try and get as much down of these personal stories as I can. Having said that, it's not just about recording people's stories. It's about the fact that there was just looking at this period, this being specific is really, I think, the only way you can get to understand the broader picture, in my view.
So what do you hope that people take? Because people might think, oh, here we go. I mean, I'm not sounding facile, but it's another, we have, in the history of throughout Europe, we think about the killings after the massacre, the massacre after the killing of Heydrich, for example. And yeah, there are stories of Nazi atrocities on the Eastern Front that, are just horrendous. So rather than just, another Nazi story, what do you hope that people take from Silent Village?
Well, the thing about Silent Village, and I made this decision really quite early on, is actually I don't really talk about the Panzer Division at all. I mention them in passing. I mention them I say why they were there and that kind of thing, but I don't talk about them as people. This is about the people in Oradour. And actually, my interest isn't in military history. My interest is in social history primarily. So I'm more interested in people and their everyday lives, and how what happened throughout that period affected a village. Now, up to the point of halfway through the book, where the story of the 10th of June is told, I could be talking about any village. I could be talking about any village along that tram line. You know, it's just, I'm talking about how people came to be in that place at that moment in time. So I'm not, you know, this probably isn't a book for the military historians. It's a book for people who want to understand, you know, about the way, how, what life was like. You mentioned earlier on, you know, what was life like, you know, and I talk about even down to how people made the cider and how people, you know, got their milk in the mornings and all that kind of stuff. So, yes, I do then tell the story of what happened on that day, but I tell it through the eyes of the people who were there. So I took witness statements that were, you know, there were a number of survivors, because we've got to remember that it wasn't just the people. When we talk about this very small number of survivors, we're not talking, we're talking about the people who were in the barns or in the church. Only one woman escaped from the church. But as the Germans were approaching, we've got to remember people hid and people did get away. So there were people who were, for example, under surveillance by Vichy, who knew to hide, they knew to get away, or there were people who were Jewish who hid. So we're not talking about huge numbers here. We're talking probably about 20, 25 people who got away for that reason as well. But that's also, I think, interesting that I think. The thing about this story is that Oradour was it was preserved as this martyred village, and Charles de Gaulle was very keen for it to be seen as a place that had been martyred and it was innocent, and it wasn't, you know, it's France's ultimate kind of sacrifice. The thing is, though, that at the same time, de Gaulle wanted to represent France as a nation of resistance, and this has been a kind of an ongoing battle then, as through the 1980s and 1990s, as France was trying to come to terms with what actually happened and the deportation of the Jews and its kind of guilt in all that, was that people were having to reassess this idea that France was a nation of resistance, because actually the resistance were very small numbers. Until after the 6th of June, the resistance, you know, not many people did that. Not at the same time, not many people collaborated. Most people just tried to get by, you know, and they did whatever they could. So then you've got this interesting question where you've got, you know, everyone who comes to Oradour is faced with this martyred village. And even in the exhibition, as you go into the place, it's talking about the resistance. But then you've had a lot of French revisionist authors trying to place the resistance within Oradour, and that is really upsetting for the people of Oradour, because it takes away that innocence.
Yeah, but the French political landscape since 1940 and Vichy and the revisionment and the whole political landscape of Paris and France, and people desperately trying to cover up, if you like, because of what happened during the occupation is a separate interview and a minefield in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. it is, but it's interesting that you know, we, in this book, I kind of wanted to just sort of say, look, you know, this is how it was at this moment in time. Yes, there was resistance all around. And yes, the destruction of this village was because of resistance. But at the same time, there was no one in this, there was nothing that happened in this village that caused it to get chosen. And I pretty much prove it, you know, in the book. This was a very random choice. It was a choice. It was convenient. That's all it was. So, you know, I am retaining that innocence, but at the same time, I'm putting the context there so people can understand you know, if it hadn't have been our hardware, it would have been somewhere else.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is it's sometimes the private stories that bring the big picture to life, if you like.
Absolutely, yeah.
The book is called Silent Village. We're going to crash the news, as we say, Robert, because it's been such a good conversation. The book is called Silent Village. It's by Robert Pike. It's out now. Is it out on History Press?
Yeah, no, it's not quite yet. You can pre-order it on Amazon, anywhere like that. You can pre-order it. I think it's due out on the 30th, I believe.
And you have your own excellent website as well, which I'm currently perusing as we speak.
Yeah, well, that's got some nice videos and blog posts and tastes for the book. And also, you can follow me on Twitter at Pike Robert. I'll post any new sort of blog posts and things on there.
The website is robertpike.co.uk. Yeah. This book is called Silent Village. It's by Robert Pike. Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thanks for having me on, Joss.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.